Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a widely publicized scoop by BuzzFeed News that the president had directed his fixer, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress over plans to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, which prompted special counsel Robert Mueller's office to take the unusual step of issuing a statement saying claims in the story are not accurate. Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist who writes about national security and civil liberties at emptywheel.net and serves on the advisory committee for the House Fourth Amendment Caucus and is a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, joins us. We'll discuss the likelihood that the source for BuzzFeed are FBI agents connected to the Southern District of New York's investigation of Michael Cohen following their raid on his home, office, and hotel rooms, which netted a huge cache of tapes, records, and documents. We will assess whether the tight-lipped Mueller team are slapping down anyone who might steal the thunder of their forthcoming report, or, in issuing the unusual statement disputing the BuzzFeed report, are they acting under pressure from the White House, still smarting from BuzzFeed's release of the Steele dossier containing salacious details of Trump's alleged activities in the presidential suite of the Ritz Hotel in Moscow in November of 2013. Then we will speak with a former White House counsel to President Obama, Andy Wright, a senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security, where he has an article, The Enigma of Bill Barr. He joins us to discuss how the walls are closing in on Trump as anticipation grows for the timely release of the Mueller report and the uncertainty surrounding the gatekeepers at the Justice Department overseeing the report, who are in charge of whether it is released to the public and the Congress, and in what form it will emerge after redactions of grand jury testimony and classified material. Then finally, we'll assess the president's address to the nation on Saturday, in which he offered a plan to end the government shutdown by offering temporary protection from deportation for some undocumented immigrants in exchange for $5.7 billion in funding for his wall. Margaret Hugh, a professor of law at Washington and Lee University School of Law, who served as a senior policy advisor for the White House and in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, joins us to discuss Trump's offer, which has been snubbed by the Democrats and many on the right, and whether Trump was successful in shifting the political dynamics away from blaming him for the longest shutdown in history. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist who writes about national security and civil liberties at emptywheel.net and is a contributor to Motherboard, The New Republic, and MSNBC, among others. She's the author of The Anatomy of Deceit, a primer on the CIA leak investigation, and live-blogged the Scooter Libby trial. Marcy serves on the advisory committee for the House Fourth Amendment Caucus and is a senior fellow at George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security and was declared an Internet Human Rights Hero by Access Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marcy Wheeler.
Thanks for having me.
And Marcy, what do you make of the special counsel who made an unusual move in refuting, in part, the BuzzFeed story by Jason Leopold and Anthony Cormier, asserting that Cohen had told special counsel investigators that after the election, the president personally instructed him to lie by claiming that negotiations for a Trump Tower in Moscow ended months earlier than they actually did. What do you think happened there?
Well, I think two things happened, and this partly reflects subsequent Washington Post reporting and some work I've done to corroborate what they claim. The first thing that's clear is when BuzzFeed contacted special counsel's office earlier in the week, special counsel's office tried to get them to look at Cohen's allocution. So this is what Cohen pled to last year. to get them to notice that what Cohen said was far less strong than what BuzzFeed was saying. So in other words, Cohen basically said, I decided to lie because I knew exactly what message Trump wanted out there, and I made that happen. And that's what Mueller had Cohen say, because that's what Mueller is confident they've got the corroboration to prove in court. BuzzFeed claimed and still claims that they have evidence that says Trump was much more involved in that. And those views are not actually conflicting. What Mueller is doing is saying, here's what the story of our prosecution is going to be. Here's what we are happy to prove with somebody who's already pled guilty to lying, right? So they've got a witness who's not terrifically credible, so they have to make sure they're not promising he can testify to and prove anything beyond what they've got other corroborating evidence for. What BuzzFeed is saying is, we know it went further than that. We know Trump had a more active role in Cohen's story than that. And I suspect that that's also true. What's interesting, and I pointed this out, is that Southern District of New York, which also has Cohen pleading to basically deceiving people for Trump, they're much stronger about Trump's role in that. And that might either be because Cohen was still working directly for Trump at the time, or it may be that SDNY, the Manhattan prosecutors, don't have to rely on Cohen testifying on the stand, and therefore they can say what they believed to know, which is that Trump ordered Cohen to make it happen and Cohen made it happen. Again, none of these things are in conflict. Mueller just had an incentive to kind of tamp BuzzFeed down because I don't know for sure there's going to be a prosecution, but they may need to put Cohen on the stand, and they can't get him to say anything further. They can't promise that they can prove anything further than that they know that they have backup evidence for. So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that it's essentially what's going on with the special counsel is they don't want anybody to steal their thunder, that the Southern District of New York, they probably have all that stuff, don't they, from the raid of Cohen's house, office, and hotel room? And do you think, therefore, that the BuzzFeed source is in the Southern District of New York?
Well, I think that's likely, and I say that for a couple reasons. As you point out, when I say Southern District of New York, I should clarify, that could be either attorneys in that office, or more likely, given the way BuzzFeed describes their source, FBI sources. And FBI is notoriously more leaky than Southern District prosecutors are in any case. But whichever it is, I think that that's also likely because the way in which nothing in the BuzzFeed story goes beyond what appears in Cohen's sentencing memo. So in other words, Mueller's people and SDNY's people got together and they said, here is what we want to focus on in the sentencing memo. And that's precisely what the BuzzFeed story focuses on. So they don't tell us, for example, how the Trump Tower deal relates to the stolen emails. They only tell us that, you know, how long it went on, which are the same details that make it into the sentencing memo. And so that suggests that BuzzFeed sources probably don't have any more visibility on what Cohen told Mueller's people than what you would get out of those discussions about the sentencing memo.
And again, I'm speaking with Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist who writes about national security and civil liberties at emptywheel.net and is a contributor to Motherboard, The New Republic, and MSNBC. She's the author of Anatomy of Deceit, a primer on the CIA leak investigation, and live blog, The Scooter Libby Trial. Marcy serves on the Advisory Committee for the House Fourth Amendment Caucus and is a senior fellow at George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, and was declared an Internet Human Rights Hero by Access Now. So since you live blogged the Scooter Libby trial, Marcy, wasn't that where Jason Leopold got into trouble when he was writing for Truthout?
Well, what happened there, and this has been written up by other people, is that the FBI had abundant evidence that Karl Rove had leaked Valerie Plame's identity. Even at the trial, it was clear that Karl Rove had hidden a conversation with – this was 12 years ago. But,
right.
I mean, it was clear that Karl Rove had hidden conversations with – that there were parts of Karl Rove's testimony that were still being massaged at that point. And I think what the record shows in 2005, so gosh, this is a long time ago, is that Jason was right that there were people in that prosecution team that wanted to that believed Karl Rove had done what had lied, but it ended up being the case that the prosecutors didn't think that they could convict him, or for other reasons chose not to indict him when they indicted Scooter Libby. So I think that that's what happened in that case. I think the difference today is that Jason's working with another great investigative journal. I mean, Jason's got many more years under his belt. He's working with another great investigative journalist, Anthony Cormier, and they're both very active on this story. They've got a great editor and a great editorial team around them. And so I think it's highly unlikely that Leopold is as far over his skis on this story as he was in 2005. And frankly, the claims he's making really have been largely corroborated. You know, if you look at the legal exposure of Trump, if he allowed Cohen and his son and Felix Sater all to lie under oath to Congress, which they all did, if he allowed that to happen knowing that it was false, then he's still guilty of allowing them to lie. If his lawyers, if Trump Organization lawyers were involved in crafting this lie, and that is consistent with Mueller's testimony, if there were more discussions with people at the White House, that's consistent with Mueller's testimony, then Trump's still on the hook for the lies. The question, you know, I think what we're seeing with the BuzzFeed story the other day is there are two reasons I think that Mueller pushed back. And one is, as I explained, Mueller has a really high incentive to not set the bar for Michael Cohen's testimony, if it comes to that, beyond where they want to prove it. But the other thing is, and this has become clear in the last 24 hours, the Washington Post said that Rod Rosenstein's office called and said, are you guys releasing a statement? Rudy Giuliani this morning on CNN basically took credit for the fact that the special counsel's office released a statement. Washington Post has said that that was because Democrats were talking about impeachment, and I've gotten corroboration of that. So the other reason why special counsel's office released a statement is because their bosses said, you start pushing back against this conversation that's leading towards talk of impeachment. And I think that raises questions unto itself, particularly about whether Rosenstein's office and possibly his boss, Matt Whitaker, who, you know, is not a confirmed attorney general and was put in place basically to tamper with the Mueller investigation. I think that raises real questions whether somebody at DOJ and people at White House and possibly Rudy Giuliani did something that within the guidelines of the special counsel regulations is totally improper to get that statement made.
Well, Trump certainly celebrated the statement, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, Rudy Giuliani this morning said that special counsel did not do that spontaneously.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Felix Sater. I recall some emails, I think it was between him and Michael Cohen, essentially crowing about how they're just going to get this deal of the Trump Tower built in Moscow, and the boss is going to look good and they're going to look good. Do you remember that?
Right, yeah.
So give us a sense of what the connection with Felix Sater is. He's somebody that's cooperated with the feds. He has ties to the Vori, the Russian organized crime. Of course, he's famous for smashing a margarita glass in somebody's face, although I believe that was over a woman, not necessarily over some mob dispute. But in any case, is he likely to testify, do you think?
Yeah, I suspect that Mueller is trying to set the bar for Cohen's testimony as well as Sater's. Sater, we're understood that he has also been – I mean, Sater also clearly lied at least to the House Intelligence Committee and possibly in his first interview with Mueller's office. But something like six of Mueller's prosecutors have worked with him as a cooperating witness in the past. So it's unclear whether he's got his own plea deal or what his terms are. But Sater would have been very central for Mueller understanding what was going on with the Russians. And Sater does have those ties with Russians. One of the things about this deal, which doesn't ever get enough emphasis, is that Cohen basically spoke with a very close Vladimir Putin, the personal assistant of a very close Vladimir Putin aide, and said, hey, Trump is willing to work with a GRU officer, a former GRU officer, and Trump is willing to work with sanctioned banks to make this happen. He did that before the first vote was cast in 2016, and that would mean Putin would have leverage over Donald Trump from that point forward. But those were the terms on which Sater had set up this deal, and it leads me to believe he was at that point helping the Russians compromise Trump. It also, when he and Cohen started resuming conversations about this deal in May 2016 after Trump had sealed up the nomination, he moved back to traditional texts rather than deleting encrypted texts. And that would ensure that those texts would be discoverable by the U.S. government and therefore would ensure that it would be much more likely that we'd be where we are, which is that Trump that we now know that Trump was discussing a Trump Tower deal. I mean, when Don Jr. accepted a meeting from Rob Goldstone that was part of the Russian government's support for Donald Trump back in June 2016. When he accepted that meeting, he knew that that meeting might be worth $300 million to him. And that's the important context for this Trump Tower deal, is it wasn't just, you know, we'll give you dirt on Hillary Clinton if you give us sanctions relief. There was also $300 million in it for the Trump organization, and that's what the importance of this deal is.
Well, it seems like the Russians have been dangling this Trump Tower deal for the longest time. It goes back to the Soviet times when Trump and his wife Ivana, acting as a translator, went to Moscow and Leningrad back in 1987. The lure was that Trump was going to build a Trump Tower, and he would be the sort of bridge into entrepreneurial capitalism during the perestroika period. So what do you think's going on the Russian side? And also, one of the things that I hear from Russian contacts is that when it was revealed that in these negotiations, and I believe Trump met with Cohen about 10 times to talk about this deal, that the idea that Trump Tower would have a $50 million penthouse at the top that Putin would be given as a gift. Because the joke in Russia is that Putin wouldn't have accepted a $50 million penthouse. He would have wanted half of the building.
Right, yeah. And again, if I'm right that Sater was helping the Russians compromise Trump, that would expose Trump to foreign bribery regulations on top of everything else. So in other words, it might be designed to expose Trump even further than he already was. Or it might be, as Sater has claimed, just good marketing. If you associate a project with Putin, then you're going to be more likely to sell it. I don't know the truth on that. I think you're right that the Russians have dangled this over and over again with Trump, again back in 2013 with the Agalarovs. That was the deal that was on the table before the election year one. But again, with the same people who offered the election year help on the Dirt for Sanctions meeting on June 9th, 2016. And it may be that, you know, the numbers here actually probably don't add up. I mean, most of Trump's deals don't add up to $300 million, but that is what Trump expected to get out of this, which, you know, either the Russians were willing to throw a lot more money at buying a potential U.S. president, or it was a deal that was structured unlike most of their other deals, but the amount of money on the table was much higher than your typical Trump deal. And it may have been that the Russians just knew that Trump is venal and would respond to this over and over again and exercise no judgment about who he was doing business with because the amount was so stupendous.
Well, Trump himself has said that I think it was just yesterday, he said that, you know, I may not have won the election, therefore I would be back in business. I mean, that's one of the extraordinary things about this whole Trump-Russia-Putin-Trump story, is that if it's true that Putin's holding something over Trump, the implication, at least to my mind, is that Trump didn't really take it seriously. He thought the whole running for president was kind of a branding exercise, and it was a kind of an irony in a way that he won. He was sort of hoisted on his own petard of vanity. And of course, the irony there is that this is a man who's done shady deals all of his business life, and now suddenly he's in the Oval Office, the world's ultimate goldfish bowl, and he's under unbelievable scrutiny, which he's never had before.
Right. And I think Eric Trump once said that the worst thing that ever happened to his father is that he won the presidency. And I think that's right. I mean, there are a lot of people who say that Trump never expected to win. And, you know, however he did that, however important the Russian help for winning was, I think he and Mike Flynn, by the way, Flynn has said the same thing, that he was willing to do deals with the Turks, for example, on the assumption that they were never going to win. And then when they did win, all of a sudden his perjury, his lies to DOJ about what he was doing became much more problematic. And I think that that's probably true. And the Russians are just good enough at compromising somebody that they ensured they were going to win either way. They ensured that either they would have seriously damaged Hillary Clinton and would have gotten certain things from Trump along the way, but if by chance they did win, which they did, then all the better, because they don't have, you know, now they don't even have to give him the Trump Tower, because how is Trump going to collect on that? And they've got Trump on the record as promising to overturn sanctions and promising to give them what they want in Syria and promising to give them what they want in Ukraine. He hasn't been able to deliver on all of those things yet, but they have him on the record promising to do those things, which puts him in a really dangerous position for, you know, I don't care whether you're Republican or Democrat, that's a dangerous position for the American president to be in. And it appears that he's in that position.
Well, apparently, according to the recent reporting, Trump was in a few minutes of going to the microphones and announcing that the U.S. is going to pull out of NATO. And General Mattis stopped him at the last minute. So that would have been, I mean, if Trump is the gift that keeps on giving for Putin, that would have been the ultimate gift.
And we're not sure it's not going to happen yet,
exactly.
Right? I mean, reason Mattis wanted to stay for 2 months when he quit last year was to get through the next NATO meeting. He's not there now. So what's going to happen now?
Right.
Clearly, Congress is on alert for Trump doing just that. But ultimately, he's the president. And if he does that, he can do that.
Well, Marcy Wheeler, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Marcy Wheeler, who's an independent journalist who writes about national security and civil liberties at emptywheel.net, and is a contributor to Motherboard, The New Republic, and MSNBC. And she's the author of Anatomy of Deceit, a primer on the CIA leak investigation, and live blog The Scooter Libby Trial. And Marcy serves on the advisory committee of the House Fourth Amendment Caucus and is a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, and was declared an Internet Human Rights Hero by Access Now.
And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how much of the Mueller report will the new Attorney General William Barr release to the public.
You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize.
No way to hide your lying eyes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andy Wright, who's a senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security, who previously served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. And his latest article at Just Security is The Enigma of Bill Barr. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andy Wright.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Andy. And it does seem that the walls are closing in on Donald Trump. There was obviously a lot of publicity surrounding the BuzzFeed release on Friday. But the next day, of course, special counsel came out and said that, in part, that story was not accurate. And we were just talking to Marcy Wheeler about, of course, today, Rudy Giuliani more or less implied that the White House improperly, nevertheless, weighed in on the special counsel, and Donald Trump was quite happy that the counsel made that statement about saying that parts of that story were inaccurate. What do you make of it all now as the dust is settling?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell exactly what the sourcing is on BuzzFeed. I mean, my best guess would be that it's people involved in the Southern District of New York's investigations who have some evidence about what the special counsel may or may not have, rather than the special counsel's team. And it seems, in some ways, like more of a fight about the characterization of the evidence. And so I think we still really don't know who's got the better version of the truth here between the BuzzFeed story and the special counsel's office. So, but in any event, however you cut it, it's pretty clear that Cohen's version of events here is that he was going to lie to Congress, and he presented those lies to the White House, and the president, who was in a position to know that they were untrue, either under the BuzzFeed theory, directed him to lie to Congress, or under the best version of the facts for the president, sat passively by while someone was telling him that they were going to lie to Congress on the president's behalf and said nothing. So in either event, it's pretty damning evidence. However, that particular controversy shakes out.
So let's move to William Barr, who will soon be the Attorney General. And the minute that he becomes the Attorney General, he's in charge of the Mueller report, since he's not going to recuse himself in spite of his 19-page memo that he wrote for no particular reason, at least none that we've understood. It sort of came out of the blue. Unsolicited, and it got President Trump's attention because he was critical of the special counsel in the same way that Matthew Whitaker got Trump's attention by going on television and trashing the Mueller. So you're suggesting that Bill Barr is, you know, the two possibilities. Bill Barr is a Justice Department company man who is taking a final daunting assignment in public service to protect the Department of Justice from political interference from the president, to reaffirm its legitimacy in the eyes of the public and ensure the rule of law is upheld? Or is he a wolf in sheep's clothing, donning the garb of traditional attorney general paeans to independent judgment of the rule of law in order to position himself to protect Trump from ballooning federal, state, and congressional investigations? So those are the two possibilities that you pose. Could you also pose a third possibility? I don't, at the wish of sounding conspiratorial, apparently Bob Mueller's wife and Bill Barr's wife are best friends. We know not only is Bill Barr a company man, he's also a Bush man. He served for Bush Sr. Is it possible that he's basically wrote that piece as an audition to get the job to, in effect, protect Mueller?
Well, I'm not quite ready to adopt that.
No. I did preface it by saying it was a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, sure. No, but I mean, it was striking that Barr was quite adamant that he is, lifelong, or 30 years long friends with Mueller. And he made one comment during his confirmation hearing that, and we'll be friends when this is over. So he's not going to give any distance there on Mueller, and I'm sure that if President Trump was watching that, it was probably irritating to him, since he's been out there calling Mueller every name in the book and calling the whole investigation a witch hunt over and over again. But going back to what Barr is going to do as Attorney General, I mean, it's quite clear that the best way to audition for a job in the Trump Justice Department is to attack the Mueller investigation. And in some ways, Bill Barr's attacks on the investigation were sort of mild compared to the kind of stuff you're seeing on, you know, Judge Jeanine or other stuff on Fox. And they were sort of narrow, but they also show that what Barr's desired outcome here was, what he was trying to do was send signals to Trump world that he was going to be, you know, a loyal follower. So while I think the jury is out on what kind of attorney general he'll be, the troubling data points have stacked up over these years where President Trump is attacking Justice Department officials, attacking judges, you know, calling legitimate investigations a witch hunt, and Barr is, you know, engaging in debating points about whether or not the theories of the case that Mueller may be investigating are right or not, rather than, you know, shouting from the rooftops that the president is attacking the rule of law. So I'm concerned, but he was saying a lot of the right things about the Justice Department's role and the Attorney General's role as having an independent judgment and needing to follow the law and the facts where they take you. So I guess we'll see, because it doesn't look like there's going to be any stopping his confirmation.
And again, I'm speaking with Andy Wright, who's a senior fellow and founding editor at Just Security, who previously served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. And his latest article at Just Security is The Enigma of Bill Barr. So what do you think the timeline here is, Andy, before Barr takes the reins, at which point he's in charge of the Mueller inquiry and its fate?
You know, I would guess that this is going to get scheduled for a vote pretty quickly. I wouldn't be surprised if he's, you know, sworn in within the next 2 weeks. But again, with the complications of the government shutdown, you know, all bets are off in terms of everyone's schedules right now. So I'm not 100% sure what the floor time will look like. But, you know, I at this point, I don't think there are a whole lot of other steps to be taken other than the committee vote and then, you know, a floor vote. And I'm assuming that Mitch McConnell will be anxious to bring that to the floor as quickly as possible to try and put that behind him.
So what happens to Whitaker then?
At that point, you know, if Whitaker is in an acting role, he would revert back to the role that he had previously, which I believe was chief of staff to the attorney general. Now, Barr may have his own people he wants to bring in as his own chief of staff. So either Whitaker will, you know, exit the department, be reshuffled, or remain in that previous role of chief of staff to the attorney general's office.
And what about all of the concern and speculation that it's pretty likely, if not certain, that he was put in there both as the eyes and ears of the White House and to do what he could to stymie the investigation. Do you think he's done anything? Have we been too alarmed by the fact that this guy was so unqualified and so craven in auditioning for the job?
I don't think we have all the data points yet. You know, one of the big moments where we may get some information on that front is that Whitaker, after being threatened with a subpoena, finally agreed to testify in front of the House Judiciary Committee in mid-February. So at that point, I'm sure that a number of members of Congress, especially on the Democratic side, will be asking those very questions. I don't think there's been anything catastrophic done to the Mueller inquiry, because I think we would have heard leaks about that if it had happened. And, you know, don't count out the effect that all the questions about Whitaker's legitimacy to act as acting attorney general when he had not been Senate confirmed may have had on freezing him from doing the more aggressive version of Trump's bidding.
Yeah, it also seems very likely that Trump had no idea what a kind of sleazy business record this guy had, Whitaker. Not that Trump's had anything but a sleazy business record.
Well, you know, no president wants to have headaches about their subordinates. And, you know, part of the problem with President Trump is that he has attracted a lot of other people who have had fairly unsavory business dealings in the past to serve in his administration. And I'm sure it's annoying to him to have to deal with, you know, problems with the Secretary of Interior or problems about the business dealings of the acting attorney general, but, you know, that's kind of what you get when you bring that kind of folks in and you have don't have the best vetting operation.
Right. Well, let's just turn to the mechanism of this inquiry and the fact that the attorney general is in charge of it because Sessions recused himself. Rod Rosenstein ended up in charge of it. Rod Rosenstein has indicated he's leaving. So Barr comes in. He's in charge. My understanding is that the way that the rules are written, the Justice Department rules about a special counsel's investigation are that they are confidential. And the word confidential seems to cover an enormous amount of ground. So let's start with that. Can Barr basically redact anything he wants, or at least redact grand jury testimony and classified material?
Well, I would expect grand jury material and classified material to be redacted under any theory. So let's just start with there are going to be legitimate redactions made in this case. Now, there's intense public interest in seeing this report, and so much so that I would suggest that there may be legitimate declassification decisions that should be made to declassify some of the signals intelligence, foreign phone call intercepts, et cetera, if they bear directly on the central questions of this inquiry. But one thing we should all set our expectations is that, you know, the Justice Department isn't going to issue a public report that contains a bunch of grand jury testimony. That's covered by statutes. But put that to the side, there does seem to be some discretion here for the Attorney General to be sort of, you know, more fully transparent versus less. And here, you know, that's one of the big looming questions about the Barr nomination. Now, he made a commitment to the senators that he was going to be as transparent as the law would allow. But what he means by the law and regulations could mean executive privilege. And in that case, he could be really expanding the scope of the things he wants to hide from public view in a way that I think would be unacceptable given the intense public interest in this product. Now, one thing that Mueller can do is the regulations require that there be a report to Congress about any significant actions that Mueller wants to take that are disapproved by the Attorney General. So if Mueller decided he wanted to indict, say, one of Trump's children, and the Attorney General said, "You can't do that, I'm going to pull the plug," then that would require a report be given to Congress to that effect, that there was an indictment sought of Trump child X, and here was the evidentiary basis to do so, and the Attorney General said no. So there are some things that where it's beyond the Attorney General's ability to spike the report, and so it'll be interesting to see if there's been that kind of internal dust up that would trigger that provision.
So what do you expect? I mean, a lot of people have an enormous amount of anticipation about this report. And the likelihood is that it may not affect his base, particularly in terms of them sticking by him and Fox News and others that sort of, you know, put these people inside of this bubble where they're impervious to facts and evidence. That's not likely to change or shift the needle. But my sense is that what's likely to perhaps influence the base is the forthcoming testimony of Michael Cohen. Not that he's not necessarily going to be the greatest witness, and he's also, you know, a fairly well-established liar. But he apparently is going to describe who Trump really is. And to my mind, that's the ultimate wall that has to be crossed before the American people realize that they have this unstable, unqualified, and dangerous president who apparently anybody that's in the room with him knows he's completely insane. And apparently that is what Cohen's testimony is going to be about, that there's a madman in the Oval Office. Do you think that's going to move the needle?
We'll see. You know, I do think that'll be dramatic television, and it remains to be seen how Cohen performs in front of Congress. That said, I've always believed that the basic laws of political gravity have not been upset by Trump. They may have been blunted by conservative and liberal media ecosystems that are separated and other things, you know, voter suppression, you name it. There are factors now that make it harder to break up the base. But if you have economic news that's bad and you have a government shutdown that drags on and people start to get hit in their pocketbooks, their perception of these events around Mueller and Russia are going to change. And so I think, you know, while it's a delayed reaction, it's still moving only in one direction since he's become president, and it's not in his favor. So I think that Cohen's testimony could be another significant data point in that sort of loosening of his grip on his own base even.
So you don't think that there could be a kind of Howard Beale moment like the in the movie network that's now on Broadway? That
I'm not going to take it anymore.
Right. I mean, of course, Howard Beale actually made sense. He had some interesting things to say, and one would anticipate a Trump meltdown in public would be probably pretty irrational.
Yeah, well, it also is kind of like a Tuesday during his administration. So.
Right. Well, that's what's so frustrating is that, you know, there's enough reporting from people who've been on the inside and witnessed Trump's behavior, which is extraordinary. You know, so the idea that you could actually get a camera in there and or a fly on the wall, to, you know, I always refer to the when the Nixon tapes came out, the scales came off the eyes of many Americans who were appalled that their president cursed and sweared. Well, I think if Trump were to be exposed, that would be 1,000 times more dramatic.
Yeah, well, like I said, I think you're onto something that the Cohen testimony will be significant. It may be, like Nixon's lawyer. I mean, before, that was a pretty significant moment in the disclosure of the tapes. This is going to be someone who has had a long personal and professional relationship with President Trump going before his time in politics and all the way through to the Oval Office. So it will certainly be dramatic. And, I think it'll also be highly viewed by, you know, large swath of the American electorate.
Well, Andy Wright, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Andy Wright, who's a senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security, who previously served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. And his latest article at Just Security is The Enigma of Bill Barr. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an analysis of the president's address on Saturday that fell flat.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Margaret Hughes, a professor of law at Washington and Lee University School of Law, who teaches immigration policy, national security, cyber surveillance, and civil rights. Previously, she served as a senior policy advisor for the White House's Initiative on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, and also served as special policy counsel in the Office of Special Counsel for Immigration-Related Unfair Employment Practices and at the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Margaret Hughes.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in saying that President Trump's address on Saturday fell flat, I don't think I'm editorializing because the Democrats basically have said it's dead on arrival. And a lot of people on the right, like Ann Coulter, are being very critical of it, too. So what's your assessment?
Well, it seems like the stalemate continues and the shutdown is going to roll on because this has not been embraced as a compromise that either the Democrats or many Republicans actually are prepared to accept. And so it does not seem like this advances the ball on immigration reform or reopening the government.
So do you think, therefore, it's not moved the needle in terms of Trump getting out from under being blamed for a shutdown that he said he'd be proud to take the mantle for?
It does seem as if the shutdown will still be perceived as his shutdown. He did offer to extend by a number of years both the Deferred Action for Child Arrivals program for what is referred to as the Dreamers, those who enter the United States crossing the borders without documentation at a young age. He also offered to extend TPS, which is a temporary protected status program, recipients who are allowed to stay in the country and work in the United States when they come from countries that are facing natural disaster, war, famine, etc. And so even though he offered those in exchange for the $5.7 billion for the wall, that is what many Democrats are saying not sufficient, that the government shutdown holds the 800,000 government workers hostage during the negotiations process. And many are also criticizing that proposal as holding the Dreamers and the TPS workers hostage as well.
Well, one of the parts of the speech that got my attention, it wasn't a particularly long speech, was where Trump said, I'll just quote from his speech, "While many Democrats in the House and Senate would like to make a deal, Speaker Pelosi will not let them negotiate. The party has been hijacked by the open borders fringe within the party, the radical left becoming the radical Democrats." Now, I have never for the life of me, have you heard anybody in the Democratic Party call for open borders?
No. I believe that most of the Democrats who have spoken out on this issue have stated that they are in favor of border security, and they believe that border security can come in a number of ways, including higher surveillance, more sensors at the border, more immigration agents at the border, and some type of border security that might involve fencing, extending the fence that we already have, for example. And so I believe that the Democrats that have gone on the record on immigration security, border security, have stated that they're in favor of those types of measures for immigration control, as well as many Democrats and Republicans alike have stated that they are in favor of stronger interior enforcement, so programs that use more database screening, for example, that tries to detect who might be here unlawfully and then subject them to detention and an investigation of their presence. But I have not heard of anyone advocating for open borders, so an absence of border security. I haven't heard of anyone advocating for that position.
Well, I'm not even sure that is there a radical left in this country. I wish there was. I think the politics in this country so far have always been so skewed to the right compared to, say, Europe and Australia and New Zealand and other Western democracies, even Canada. What's your take on that? I mean, the idea that there's a radical left in this country that's the tail that wags the dog of the Democratic Party just seems laughable.
Well, I do believe that many in the world see the immigration programs in the United States as far as offering a pathway to citizenship and then integrating individuals into our country as being very progressive in ways that the United States is not known for having a progressive political platform in general. But there are national security experts worldwide, for example, who state that that's one of the best counterterrorism measures that we have in this country, that you can actually come into the country as somebody who is foreign-born, find a pathway to citizenship through naturalization, and then actually be accepted as a U.S. citizen in ways that in some countries abroad that national security experts have said is foreclosed from those individuals, and that is what is causing the radicalization of individuals and homegrown terrorism in other countries, in a way that they say that because the immigration policies in the United States historically have been more progressive, actually helps to reduce the risk of terrorism here in the United States.
Well, I'm living proof of that theory. I'm a naturalized citizen who had a green card, and I'm with a radical left radio station. And, you know, I mean, the only thing that I would add to what you just said, Margaret Hugh, is that I actually did come here legally by the book. And the argument a lot of Americans have is that, you know, we have a two-tiered system, those that come here legally by the book and those that come across the border.
Yes, and I think that what we're really struggling with as a country right now is the fact that we have relatively low numbers that we allocate whereby individuals can come over legally into the United States compared to historical migration patterns. And so there are those that basically argue that unless we upwardly adjust the immigration numbers for visas, et cetera, we are going to have a mismatch that, you know, the market, for example, for our labor needs in this country are at a certain point economically, is what some experts have pointed out, and that our numbers for who we allow in do not match them realistically. And so some have argued that this is creating a problem similar to what we had when we had prohibition in this country, where you can state the law is one thing, but can you enforce it on the other hand? Because perhaps the legal regime just is not realistically, you know, taking into account what is the actual behaviors and what are the actual market forces on the ground. And eventually we repealed prohibition. And there are those that say that unless we have an immigration system that increases the number of visas and work opportunities for those coming into the country and matches what we see as the real labor needs of the country, we're going to make a mockery of the rule of law.
Well, just returning to the politics of the moment, and of course the moment is dragging on for hundreds of thousands of federal workers who are not getting paid, and next Friday is going to be particularly painful for those, particularly air traffic controllers and others, not getting a second paycheck. So what's your sense of is there any – I mean, President Trump didn't even mention the government shutdown, or barely mentioned it. Certainly didn't mention the people that are suffering, and certainly didn't offer any aid and comfort to those federal employees that are expected to work for nothing and with no end in sight. So I didn't see that there was really much of a connection between the reality, the political reality, and this ongoing issue of the border and of immigration, and in this oft-used phrase, we need comprehensive immigration reform. Well, boy, is that clear, but I don't see any movement in that direction.
Yeah, it really is hard to see an end to this stalemate. And I believe that more and more Republicans are stepping forward and saying that the government should be opened while the negotiations for border security are allowed to continue. And I think that that appears to be more and more of the consensus, that these immigration issues are so complicated and require such difficult negotiations, and it's a process of negotiation that can happen over time if the government is open. And right now, because it is just a real showdown, and, you know, it's a zero-sum game, and it appears nobody wants to give in. The only way is to open the government and just have the negotiations proceed from there.
So do you think, Mitch McConnell has said today that he's going to schedule a vote this week, I think on Wednesday, on Trump's proposal. That doesn't sound like it's going to go anywhere, right?
Well, even if there's enough votes in the Senate, now you have Democratic control over the House. And so I think that that would be where you would have difficulty if you can't have the House sign on to any Senate bill. You still don't have any legislation that's going to end the shutdown. So the president has to somehow negotiate with Pelosi somehow. There has to be some type of conversation that involves Pelosi now as Speaker of the House. She is the leader of the House. She has, it appears, to have a very strong ability to manage her caucus, and nobody has peeled away from her yet that I've seen. And so long as she is managing the leadership of the House and the majority of the House to just work together with Senator Mitch McConnell on the Senate legislation is a non-starter.
Well, you know, the ugliness of it all. I mean, I don't know whether you saw, Margaret, that video of these young pro-life marchers with the MAGA hats on confronting Native Americans who are marching for Indigenous People Days, People's Day. Did you see that? This Native American elder being heckled by this young guy in a MAGA hat. I mean, it seems like this whole issue, the way that it's playing out, with particularly with Trump taking to these national addresses, again, it's all about polarizing. It's not about healing.
Well, I think that many people have pointed out that this immigration debate lends itself to what people, some have issued concern about, a white nationalist tone in the political rhetoric and the policies of this administration, and even the president himself saying that he was an American nationalist, but mm-hmm. then you have Representative King being censured because of his statements about his support for right. nationalism. And so I think that we need to confront those issues. I think that if there is a white nationalist undertone to the immigration policy, that should be confronted, and it should be confronted on those terms.
Well, there's nothing more ironic than a young white nationalist shouting at a Native American saying, build a wall, build a wall, to the Native Americans. they needed a wall to keep us out. That's white people who took over the country from them. I mean, what a terrible irony. Anyway, I digress a little, but I thank you very much for joining us, Margaret. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Margaret Hughes, a professor of law at Washington and Lee University School of Law, who teaches immigration policy, national security, cyber surveillance, and civil rights. Previously, she served as a senior policy advisor at the White House and also served as special policy counsel in the Office of Special Counsel for Immigration-Related Unfair Employment Practices and at the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.